Everyone talks big yields, but Channel Seedsmen deliver advice that yields results. Every season, Channel Seedsmen match elite seed products with unmatched service and support to push the performance of every acre. That's why you can count on Channel for what you need to make the most of your season. You don't have to be a Channel customer to take advantage of this support. Visit channel.com/agritalk to sign up and receive expert advice that yields.
It's Friday, means it's time for DT Signal to Noise. I'm John Harris, joined as always by the master prognosticator, Jim Wiesmeyer of Pro Farmer, and Annalisa Laca, Farm Journal's milk editor, as well as a policy writer for agweb.com. And, well, Jim, seems like every week now we start off talking about China. What's the latest?
We had a lot of it this week. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo met his counterpart in Hawaii, and U.S. Trade Rep Bob Lighthizer appeared before Congress for over 7 hours, and both said that Chinese officials have recommitted to purchase their pledged buys of U.S. farm products. But then President Trump, as he is wont to do, put a little more uncertainty into the marketplace when he said he reserves the option for having the U.S. decouple our policies and economy with China.
Yeah, and that's really, I think, frightening news for a lot of people to know that that's even in the president's mind right now. And in fact, I got to admit, Jim, this morning on AgriTalk, you kind of scared the bejesus out of me. Here's what you had to say.
We have an item in Pro Farmer front page that says, basically, while Trump says he does not intend to break off ties with China, we continue to fear that may be a possibility if he senses he'll lose the presidential election November 3rd.
And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago on here, that the president, we've seen the more pressure he's under, the less predictable he is.
Yes.
And you're saying that really anything could happen with China if he is under some severe electoral pressure?
If we put it in Pro Farmer, we believe it ourselves. Yes.
Wow.
Yes. And that would, of course, with China so important to U.S. trade flows, especially for the commodities we well know, but soybeans, of course, that's a major, major development.
Well, and just major development all around. And I would think, I guess, Jim, I don't see how that helps his electoral prospects to go into a full-on attack on China late in the game, in the election cycle, when rural America has been waiting and supporting the president in this trade battle with China, to see that all basically throw in the towel on that at the last minute.
Well, we didn't say it would be before the elections. Remember, there's time, you know, we didn't say that. We're still researching that one, but that could come into that awkward period between the election and a inauguration of perhaps a new president.
You're scaring me even more now, Jim.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think Jim could be onto something here, because the president's going to want to secure some kind of legacy for himself, and in his mind, being tough on China would be just that.
Yes.
Yeah, but I mean, it wouldn't be any sort of closed deal. I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, but the Chinese would look at any drastic action like that as completely temporary, just for a couple of months until the new president comes in.
That could well be. But again, that would be havoc for 3 months. You know, that could be very volatile in the marketplace. It's just something we wanted to put on in the newsletter for cautionary aspects. Let's hope that doesn't happen. But I've had too many good China watchers, tell me that that's a possibility. Not a prediction.
Well, I need to think that any kind of Chinese policy is anything but short term compared to American policy. I mean, it's just the structure of government is so much different that they take much more of a long game view of things.
Yeah. Well, now, John, to be balanced, more balanced on this, Trump really put out that tweet about this, about the decoupling, as a follow-on to Lighthizer's testimony, in which he said, no, you cannot decouple the U.S. economy with China. So that's why Trump, put the tweet out saying perhaps Lighthizer misunderstood him and it's not his fault. So I think, and it could be a typical Trump strategy of keeping all options on the table all the time for leverage.
Well, they could be both right, though, because, I mean, the president could be well positioning himself for that negotiation, saying that he is prepared to decouple somehow. But at the same time, I think Robert Lighthizer is looking at it in a more practical manner and saying that because of how we're intertwined right now, you really couldn't decouple the two economies, at least not in a short term.
Yes, I agree with the numbers involved. But again, when he put out the tweet, that did raise that as at least a possibility, you know, for the future. But there's a substantial hundreds of billions of dollars as the trade, you know, deficit shows between the U.S. and China. They're an integral part of the U.S. and the Western economy. So that would be a much more than a Cold War, by the way. That would be a frigid war in that case.
Yeah, well, and we've seen some other signs, this news that there is a cyber attack on Australia, on healthcare and government entities and some private companies. And all the reporting is that China is believed to be behind that, possibly as a warm-up for other countries such as the United States. That certainly is a significant escalation if it's true, Jim.
If it's true, yes. And the prime minister did not mention China. He just said it's a major state-oriented country that basically spelled out China. I have a couple of friends in Australia, and boy, they emailed me overnight. And that's what I woke up to very early this morning. So then I checked the Australian newspaper, which is very good, and they had it very well covered. Yeah, this is a concern. I think China has been a very negative player in the cyber war, along with Iran, Russia, and North Korea. This is the world we're in now, and I don't think that cyber warfare is going to change.
And as if we didn't have enough already throwing the whole China relationship into a tizzy, we get excerpts from John Bolton's book coming out in the last couple of days. And Bolton claiming that President Trump, in Bolton's words, begged President Xi to help Trump in the election. And that help came in the form of commitments for purchases for U.S. ag goods.
Well, I don't think that's too bad from an agriculture's perspective. We shouldn't be surprised if it's true. You know, I'm speculating, I said it on AgriTalk as well, that I would surmise that Bolton was one of the leakers, potential leakers in the Trump administration, both before he got in and after he got in. And he had a definite, very hawkish foreign policy. Trump did not follow through on a lot of the things that he believes in. So it could be sour grapes. And then we had both Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Lighthizer. Lighthizer, during the hearing, was asked about some of those comments when Trump met with China leader Xi Jinping. And he flat out said, I was in the same meeting and it's absolutely untrue. I'm going to go with Lighthizer because I have more decades of watching him and monitoring him. So until we can see vivid proof, it's he said, he said, and I believe Pompeo and Lighthizer. I just think it's another tell-all book. Overall, it's not the bombshells that people are making it out to be, because it's, in many cases, it's Trump being Trump.
But here's my concern in this, Jim, for agriculture is that, as you know, these things get boiled down to some form of shorthand. And the shorthand here is going to be that the favor for Trump was agricultural purchases. So those not involved in agriculture are going to say, well, ag got theirs. Why do they need any more in any of these subsequent relief bills?
Because that did not make them whole. That's why.
Well, you and I get that, but I'm saying that the shorthand is, well, you know, for those not involved in agriculture, going to think, well, I got there, so we don't need to do anything more for them.
Yeah, I hear where you're coming from, but there is bipartisan support still on Capitol Hill, and this is one big issue, for additional multi-billion dollar income transfers to the ag and food sector. On that one, I don't see any withdrawal of support on that, both Democrats and Republicans. And that's why, John, on ProFarmer.com in my policy updates this morning, I just put out a chart that I forecast farm income, because I don't believe those farm income forecasts for 2020 by FAPRI and USDA easily and others who are not counting at least $8 billion, I think, of additional farm sector payments that's going to be made between now and the end of the year, above and beyond what we've seen, the $19 billion in CFAP. So I think they're understating farm income. The support for income transfer is in town, both Democrats and Republicans, and that's going to translate to a significant government or taxpayer payments to farmers of probably around 42% of all farm income, and that's a record.
Wow. So what is your projection for overall farm income?
I don't know the final number. I'd have to look at the chart again. All I know is that the gap between revenue and farm program payments is narrowing. And that shows you, as revenue goes down, the income transfers go up. And of course, we got to turn that around the other way. We need higher flat cash prices, and thus the need for reduced farm income expenditures. But until we get out of this issue a day from both the market, with the meat industry issues, with the COVID-19, the meat processing, the trade policy issues, that's the role. If there's ever a role for government, that's it, because of the working capital continues to go down in agriculture.
But Annalisa, we hear what Jim's saying, but you know, looking into your crystal ball, you see nothing but uncertainty well into 2021 for the ag sector.
Yeah, I mean, I think just like any year, we have a normal amount of uncertainty, right? We have weather, we have markets. But when you layer on a presidential election and the level of government intervention that we're seeing now in these markets, the unpredictability is really unmeasurable at this point. And so to really truly know, to Jim's point, you know, payments are going to help a lot, but to really truly know what farm income is going to net out at the end of the year, I think is near impossible at this point.
But let's take a look at the China to you know, connect dots. If China is true in that they're going to fulfill those commitments, even though I think they're going to take into the first quarter of 2021 to do it, you're going to have a substantial rally in a number of commodities, perhaps cotton, for sure, soybeans, et cetera. And look at the case, what we've recently seen, and Anna, you know, you can talk to this, relative to dairy. Are they over $20 a hundredweight, class three futures?
Yeah.
A pretty big run up from the horrible lows we saw earlier this year, where a lot of red ink. So it can happen to other commodities, because there's reports today. One of our best China watchers emailed us and saying the reports are that China could announce an additional 5 million tons of corn for their tariffs enrollment. So that'll be a shot in the arm if it's true for corn. It looks like they're seeking buyers for U.S. ethanol, spring wheat, other commodities, especially soybeans. So I'm not going to give up on revenue being as low at what USDA says.
Well, and we've seen the buys continue this week, Jim. So the good news is there is shape for something even more to come on. We just, you know, I think farmers are, and I think more than just farmers, are getting tired of being buffeted around, but there are signs that this could indeed pay off as we get deeper into the growing season and into the fall.
Absolutely. And what we've said before in this program, China is waiting for protein levels for new crop soybeans. But, you know, Brazil and Argentina, they're dust in the bins on their old crop beans. And so they're selling new crops. So that leaves us with an open window here from now until February, at least, you know, next year. So it looks pretty good for soybeans, but as Brian Grady from Pro Farmer told me, that notwithstanding, a farmer should still sell the rallies because of the carryover situation that we've already brought up.
Well, that's what I was just going to add. You know, all three of us know, Jim, you know the best, that a bull market runs as quickly as it does up, like it has in the dairy market, and tends to come back down just as quickly as it's gone up. And farmers really need to be taking advantage of that when they can.
Yes. You can't go bankrupt making money. My father always taught me. So sell when you have a profit, at least a portion, not everything. At least cover your non-postponable cost so you're protected, you know, with your banker.
Well, you sounded like Chip Flory there.
Probably. We've taught each other over the decades.
There you go. All right, well, let's move on to ethanol and a surprise this, well, somewhat of a surprise, that the EPA listed on their website late Thursday 52 new renewable fuel standard waiver requests from oil refineries. And not to get too deep in the weeds, but for those who haven't been following the story, the 10th Circuit Court ruled that a certain number of waivers were not proper because the waivers were supposed to be extensions of existing waivers, and these were the companies that got these waivers hadn't gotten waivers in the intervening years. So those companies have now come back and said, okay, well, we'll file for waivers for those years that we missed it, so it'll all be an extension. That, well, first of all, Jim, even if EPA were to approve, do you think that strategy works with the court?
Well, again, I think the key for this whole thing is what we're going to be seeing coming up. The big test for these waivers, John, or the broader court challenge, where oral arguments are set for September the 25th. So this is going to linger for a while. And that's a case before the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So I would watch that. But we heard the same pro and con on this that you can put in a macro key. The biofuel proponents said by rolling back the clock, there's no length EPA won't go to help refiners undermine the RFS. It's just an end around. The oil refiners argue the law allows small refiners to apply for relief, quote, at any time. But I keep saying the bottom line continues. We won't know this until after the November 3rd elections, but EPA has already promised that, including waivers, the RFS mandate for corn-based ethanol is 15 billion gallons. So I don't know what the argument's about here.
Well, I mean, we the renewable fuels industry is pretty suspect of whether or not EPA will come through on that 15 billion gallons, and rightfully so. They've been tossed all over the place over the last year by this administration, thinking they've got deals and then finding out they don't. So I can understand why they're not exactly jumping up and down in support of EPA saying that they're going to get 15 billion gallons.
We'll have to see. But again, we won't know until after the election. But right. There's always other elections after this one. So let them vote. Let them vote in the midterm elections after 2020 to show their signal. But again, I'm just saying, hey, this is pretty vivid even for EPA to commit several times and to throw that into court, because both sides in the biofuel and the both sides, the refiners and the producers, always go to court anyway, so take them to court.
Yeah, and of course the other argument that I'm sure will come from the biofuels industry as well, we could have surpassed the 15 billion gallons had we not gotten all these waivers. Take it for what you will.
Yes.
But I'm sure that will be what some of the argument is on
yes.
this. So you said it's September when we see that come up next.
Yeah, late in September. So yeah, that's going to, and that comes before the election. So we're going to get another gut check on this issue. And as you get closer and closer to the election, I think the political people advising Trump, definitely this should be on their radar. And you're seeing the Iowa poll, Des Moines Register poll saying, the Trump-Biden race is within the margin of error, and Trump cannot lose Iowa. So I think that should bode well for him, hopefully finally understanding the holy grail issue for corn producers, other than the price situation, is the RFS. So we'll see.
Yeah, I know you guys were talking about Iowa during AgriTalk this morning. I looked up on 538 to see what polling had been done in Iowa recently. There were three done in the month of June. Two of those polls had Trump plus one, so within the margin of error. The other one was a dead heat between Trump and Biden. So Obviously, no clear lead in the state of Iowa at this point.
And he won Iowa last time, I believe, by 9 points.
Yeah, and speaking of 9 points, I don't know if you saw this, Jim. Hat tip to Politico, I believe it was, that put this out, looked at a Fox News poll that came out that had Trump down significantly nationally, but pointed out that I need to find this now.
Yeah, that was yesterday's poll. I think it went up. It went down. His favorability went down 2 points, I think, in the race between Biden.
Yeah, but what was significant in this that they pointed out was that Trump among rural voters was plus 9 compared to plus 30 in the 2016 election.
That was national poll?
That was nationally, yes.
Yeah, see, for president, I've learned from the Cook Political Report, don't trust national polls. Go state by state.
Well, and yeah, especially when you have to look at electoral votes, but just as far as a trend line issue, I think that's an interesting look, but you're right.
It's something to at least check out and be aware of on that one. But that shows some erosion if that's the case, for sure.
Yeah, indeed. Let's turn to dicamba. That story is continuing this week. In fact, as we sit here right now on Friday afternoon, we are waiting, kind of half expecting the Ninth Circuit Court to issue a statement yet possibly this afternoon about some challenges that have been going back and forth. As you may remember, EPA canceled the label, but said that existing supply could still be applied. Those who filed the lawsuit against the dicamba registrations have appealed to the court to say, no, that's not proper. That should be stopped altogether. As it stands right now, the applications can go on, but we're waiting to see if the Ninth Circuit Court decides to change that. Annalisa, what's your sense on this as we wait for word from the court?
Well, I mean, there is nothing less predictable than a California Supreme Court. So who knows when we'll find out, but the more they drag their feet, the longer this takes, the more field work we get done. So I don't think any farmers are complaining about their delay here. You know, we've got to get this dicamba put on these beans in the areas that we still can while we still can, and then we'll reevaluate from there.
And I believe EPA said over the weekend last week that they believe they can do such action on those dates that we mentioned through the FIFRA Act. So that could well be under court consideration as well to go through the body of that law.
Indeed, and to your point, Annalisa, the longer they go on waiting for any sort of statement from the court or ruling from the court is good for farmers because absolutely, they can still go apply. And we're, for all intents and purposes, another week in the application window, right?
In a lot of places, yeah.
Yeah, there are some that extend beyond that, but for the bulk of them, next week. In fact, we put out a Pulse poll yesterday that I'm looking at right now on asking how much of your application is do you still have to make for dicamba? 36% say they are complete with their application. So there is a significant number that are completely done. Another 16% say, or 18% say they're under 25%. 14% 25 to 50, and 33% say they have more than half of their dicamba application still have to make. So there is a lot yet to be done out there.
Yeah. And I think, when you consider two replant acres, some of those are not going to get planted quickly enough to meet state deadlines for dicamba. But then when you also just factor in, we had a really great start to the planting season, and then we did get a lot of rain in a lot of areas for quite some time. So there's farmers that are still trying to get seed in the ground. And like to your point and to the pulse point, still a lot of farmers that just need to get caught up on field work. And hopefully, the warmer and drier weather pattern that we're experiencing right now through much of the Midwest will help with that.
And hopefully they can still have access to it because let's face it, people have had to be a little bit creative if they didn't have it already sitting on their farm. They had to find an applicator who already had it on hand and can make that application. So it's been a bit of a challenge. Jim, let's turn to the USTR. As you mentioned, Robert Lighthizer spent, 7 hours testifying before Congress?
Over, yeah.
Yeah. A big part of that conversation had to do with pushing for changes at the World Trade Organization. What is the U.S. looking for here, Jim?
Well, they just want on the challenges on the trade agreement. They think that the current WTO dictates too much, and he wants a narrower avenue of what they can even look at. So the U.S. wants substantial reform of the WTO, and frankly, a lot of people in this town, would agree with that, and even some farm groups.
Yeah, it seems to be more often than not the U.S. gets action taken against it more than it finds protection elsewhere.
Well, I've looked into that, although we won by far the majority of our cases that we filed. But usually the current U.S. Trade Rep's office will tell you, but what happened after we won? There was failure to follow through on the U.S. victory. So that's what they're upset. Follow through on the dispute resolution process. And again, that needs to be reformed. And I remember one of the smartest people in agriculture or in life that I've ever known, former USDA Secretary Clayton Yeider, former USTR, by the way. He had a host of other former ambassador to Japan, et cetera, White House official. He told me that he thought the future should be reforming the WTO rather than to come up with a very hard to get new round of issues. And he dealt with the dispute resolution process. He was spot on, as he usually was in his life.
Well, in fact, both the administration and Robert Lighthizer in particular have basically said they want to have a larger voice in selection of the next head of the WTO.
Yeah, that usually raises kerfuffles all over the place. Others want it to be a developing country, et cetera. But I just think this is the more aggressive tone that this administration, led by Trump, followed up in consort by Lighthizer and others, Greg Dowd, the ag chief at USDR. They're consistent that they want to be more formidable in trade policy, including the WTO.
But it's not going to be American. It's not going to be someone from China. It's not going to be someone from Russia.
No, but that could temper the process of who eventually is chosen, and giving them clear signals, once they get in. At least that's what I think. I just think I'll go back to the dispute resolution. It's kind of a joke right now, because minimum, it usually takes 2 years before you get a final, decision. And I said before, even if you win, there's lack of follow through in many situations. So what do you really have?
So where's the signal? Where's the noise in this discussion this week?
The signal is that there better be changes in the WTO. It's also needed. The rule of law is also needed in trade. And I think their pluses far outweigh the minuses. The noise is what you just said. I don't think U.S. does not have the votes in the body to get any WTO, director general to be from this great country. So that's noise there.
All right. A couple last things, Jim. This morning on AgriTalk, you said whoever wins the White House wins the Senate.
Yeah, because the presidential election this year is going to have coattails in a number of key, Senate races. Look at Montana, where the Cook Political Report this year moved it to just this week, moved it to a toss up. Where Senator Daines and existing governor, very popular Democratic Governor Bullock. So if the presidential race brings more voters out, that could turn. And that's one that was supposedly very leaning, Republican before Bullock got into that race. We've already mentioned Iowa. If Trump were to lose Iowa, he'd probably lose the Senator Ernst race. and in a number of other close races, Maine with Susan Collins, and you have some others, North Carolina, Tillis. If Biden could get out the very critical Black American vote, African American vote, 40 years or younger, Tillis could be in trouble in North Carolina, and it's starting to add up there because
that sector is very energized right now.
I'm sorry,
that sector is very energized right now. We'll see if it carries through to November, but there are signs that it is something that could keep that younger African American sector, the electorate, very engaged through November.
Yeah, as a history person in college. We're going through a cultural revolution right now, mm-hmm. and you're seeing it, you're witnessing it. And a major part of that is the, Black American, voters. And that could translate into the polls, John. And we saw Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat from, Minnesota, take herself out of the race. The VP race,
right?
Because that's the old adage where you take yourself out when you know you're not going to get it. But she also implored Biden to pick a candidate of color. And I know we commented on this last week, and at least the consensus now, it could well be, Senator Kamala Harris, but there are other ones that are coming up. But I think Biden will indeed try to get to energize that critical, African-American vote, the younger vote. And there's different ways to do it.
When was the last time that one party had the White House, the House and the Senate?
Well, the Republicans did in the first 2 years of the Trump administration, but we had what turned out to be a very weak, a House Speaker from, Wisconsin. Can't even remember his name right now, because they could have changed Obamacare and he didn't even bring it up. So, when you have a triad approach, if you win the White House and the Senate, history shows that your first 2 years in office, you mainly have two issues that you can focus on and get. Obama did the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, and he also did the Dodd-Frank. He chose not to go the climate change route. But that's very typical. And if the Democrats were to sweep, again, the White House, House, and Senate, the question I usually get in is, will the Democrats in the Senate do away with the filibuster rule? In other words, just have majority rule so they can really sweep and get a lot of stuff that they want. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think they could do it selectively on certain issues, but I don't want to get too wonky on you. They'll probably use what we call budget reconciliation on certain issues, because that's, again, how we got the Affordable Care Act, where they just needed a majority vote. And they got it. So those are the issues that I'm starting to get questions on right now if you have a sweep, because the so-called election experts are beginning to signal that. But we're, a little over 4 months away from the election? And look what we've gone through the last 3 months on changes. Yeah. Oh, my God. I just think it's too soon. And Trump has not even gone on the attack yet, as we know. Trump can to see, and it depends on the economy. If this economy continues to show progress into a semi V-shaped recovery, that'll be a feather in his cap. And then he can dig into Biden in the potentially 4 debates. And Trump is still relatively competitive in the 6 key critical states in the Electoral College. So there's your gambit. Biden can be ahead in the polls, 8, 9, 10, 12, percentage points. It's too soon.
And again, it depends on which states he's ahead by that much.
Yes.
And Jim, not to correct you, but I'm going to correct you, because this show is nothing if not wonky.
it's made to be wonky, but hopefully we come to conclusions with the signal rarely and the noise a lot. So we'll tend to bottom line still.
All right. Hey, and Jim, last week when we were on this discussion, you brought up that somebody that we know fairly well is at least in discussions about being USDA secretary if indeed Joe Biden were to win. And you got to poker on it a little bit this morning.
Yeah, it was kind of fun on AgriTalk where Pam Johnson, who was a key cohort in the ag area for Amy Klobuchar and a farmer, I love farmers who are on the program, from Iowa, and of course, Chip asked her, would you take it, et cetera, and she said what she should have, you know, politically, even though she said she's not a politician, she said no comment.
Indeed. And I think we would all be behind Pam Johnson if she were to be put in that position. But another name you brought up, Krista Harden
Krista Harden was chief of staff for Vilsack when he was USDA secretary, and recall that Vilsack came out pretty early for Biden. So it can go many ways. What I said last week, it's the silliest parlor game in town to guess a potential USDA secretary under any new, you know, president, but we love to play the game because that's what we're to do. Signal to noise. What signal? What's noise?
That's right.
But I hear a lot of signals that it could be Michael Skuse, who was under Secretary of Agriculture under Obama administration and from New England, or it could be Nikki Fried, the ag commissioner from Florida. All those have odds. They would be on the short list. Krista Harden is now in the food aid area, I believe. She was at Corteva for a while and did some farm program work before. And I will tell you that Krista Harden is well respected in this town on a bipartisan level. And that's hard to get. And of course, we know Pam. So what we know that she's market oriented. Sorry, Pam, but you've got dirt under your fingers, and that's a plus. That's not a minus. So she would bring a farmer perspective. But if you listen to Pam and sort out the woe is me stuff, she's market oriented. And I'll go to bat for anybody who wants the market to give them the income rather than government.
And the point I was going to make about Kristen is that she also got a very warm reception among that group on agriculture on AgriTalk this morning.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because of her, your history is your current. Okay. of feelings. And she's done well with reporters, with analysts, et cetera. And I speak very highly of her.
All right, you ready for a lightning round, Jim?
I am. We're going to start a lightning round here. Got a bottom line. Now, this is going to be either signal or noise right away. Here we go, John.
All right, feel free to jump in on these, Annalisa. This is Jim's idea, so if this falls apart, it's his fault. If it's glorious, we'll give Jim the credit. All right, number one, when will Congress finish a new COVID or stimulus aid round? You said June earlier.
August.
You're August now, huh?
This is a change. Well, no, and then I modified it to July. They're going to debate it in July after the July 4th recess. It could still come in July, but I would signal it could take before they go out for the August recess if they do.
All right, so you're pushing that one back.
They're supposed to be lightning round answers.
Okay, they're light. Well, that's not bad. Lightning round, July, August. Yes, for the aid, either July or August. Period.
All right. Well, how much aid? I'm throwing that one in there on you.
At least $8 billion.
Okay. Is there going to be a multi-billion dollar infrastructure bill?
No.
It's dead now, huh?
How about that one? No, it's not dead. It's just not.
Well, this year. Yeah.
This year. How about that? Pretty quick, huh?
And that's a surprise for me. What are farmers telling you that they want in the next aid package?
They don't want it to run like CFAP. They want it to run more along the lines of the Trade Mitigation Program, MFP, and based on historical production.
You've been talking to corn, soybean, and cotton growers, haven't you?
Absolutely.
Yes, Annalisa?
I was just going to say they want payment on new crop.
Yeah, they want payment on new crop, indeed.
Well, yeah, it'll has to be based on the COVID impact, but then it's what's the formula, and that's up for debate. But they do want the House and Senate Ag Committee to become more involved because they don't want it to be dictated by perhaps a one economist at USDA.
All right.
That was a signal.
Yeah, that was a signal there. And I think that's an economist we talked to this week. What are your sources saying for outlook of farm real estate?
As goes interest rates, as goes farmland prices, steady to higher. But sooner or later, we're going to have higher commodity prices to continue the run-up in land values. But there's clouds on the horizon. It's called $26 trillion debt that will have to be paid for.
All right, we touched on this one earlier, but I'm going to throw it back in here. If Trump loses the November 3rd election, if he thinks he's going to lose the November 3rd election, how does that impact his approach on China?
Well, as I said before, he could get very aggressive on China and going out as the warrior who was the only president to look them in the eyes, to use a Bush term, and see not much in their soul. And he wants to decouple significantly from China, bring back jobs to America in the Western world.
All right. The new WOTUS, does it survive a court challenge?
It's going to be temporarily probably put on pause, but eventually it'll be found to be okay. But again, we're talking courts, and it looks like that there could be some hiccups.
All right. And what was the major impact of the Supreme Court's ruling this week on DACA, the Dreamers Act?
Temporary. It showed that Trump's lawyers were messy in how they did it, and they have to go back and do their homework and do proper procedure. Once that happens, it'll come after the election, and by that time, Congress will take care of it.
Yeah, what kind of a smackdown is that when the Supreme Court says, it's not that you can't do this, yes. It's just you screwed up doing it.
Yeah, it was the process. Talk about wonky. But actually, the signal I'm getting from a number of Republicans in close elections, they liked it because it doesn't put them on the spot for a number of the DACA people and the perception. So I think this is punted to a new Congress who will eventually, finally, fix it legislatively.
All right. Well, as we wrap it up every week, we'll start with Jim. Where are you watching this next week?
Whether China continues to buy. And even though it's only May, their historical pattern is October through March of the following year. But it looks like there's fodder, more than just fodder, clear signals that we're getting that they are on an aggressive pace to purchase a host of U.S. farm commodities. And if that's the case, we're going to have a pretty good run-up in a number of commodities. Sell them.
So, all right, Annalisa, where are you watching?
Similar, watching China trade to see what happens and if we get any closer to fulfillment of phase one and if that looks like that could happen this year. And then also watching, as you mentioned, planning progress and growth stages to see what nets out with this Dicamba situation.
All right, and speaking of watching, if you're listening to this podcast right now and you want to see our glorious faces, go through Signal to Noise. Go to agweb.com, look for the Signal to Noise story on AgWeb, and you can watch this whole thing. See everything up there.
And John, if you could, put out the farm income chart graphic that I put in on Pro Farmers, policy updates to show where we see the income estimate going, if you can.
Okay. We'll talk to Eric, our producer, about that as soon as we're done. And one quick programming note, we will not be here next week. I'm going to be off on vacation. So
okay.
Enjoy a week off. We'll be back. Yeah. So we'll be back in a couple of weeks. That's going to wrap it up for Jim Wiesmer, Annalisa Laca. I'm John Harris for this week's edition of DC Signal to Noise.